Isaiah 7:14, the Lord himself, and this is spoken to Ahaz the king, the tepid, frightened little king, and who actually killed his own firstborn son, by the way, had him burned out in to Moloch, the god of out in the valley of Gehenna, because he was so afraid, hoping that the pagan gods would come and be on his side. But he had another son we're going to speak about in a moment, and the prophet promised him. He said, the maiden is with child. Yeah, presumably, I wouldn't be absolutely certain, but Ahaz's wife is with child and will soon give birth to a son whom he will call Emmanuel, a word which means God with us. He promised him as a sign of God's fidelity to him that God would give him another son, and that that son would be one in whom God would be with the land, with the people. He would be the king. And in fact, it was true. Hezekiah was the son of Ahaz and reigned after him, 715 to 687. And in his memorial, which you find in the second book of Kings, chapter 18, verse 7, it is said of Hezekiah that Yahweh was with him. He was a wonderful king, the greatest since David, and did a marvelous amount, brought the country back to prayer and back to worship of God. And the history is there to be seen in that 30 years of his reign. They said of him, Yahweh was with him. He was the promise. We're going to see a little later in this first part that while Hezekiah fulfills that prophecy or that sign, and he is the immediate object of the sign, you can see as well as I that Hezekiah didn't fully fulfill it, in the sense that he was it, but they longed for more. And we're going to see later that Jesus is seen by the New Testament as the perfect fulfillment of that, the perfect sign of it, the fulfilling sign of it. Another text spoken at the time, and all the prophets are concerned with their own time. They're real people. I haven't got the actual text written there for you, so let me just check it. It's Isaiah 11. I'm not sure, actually. So it's in the early parts of Isaiah. I think it's 11. A child is born to us, a son given to us. Dominion is laid on his shoulders, and this is the name they'll give him. And this is going to be Hezekiah. Wonder Counselor, Mighty God, noted again. Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. This king is going to be the one that's going to fulfill their dreams. He's going to be the wisdom, the wonder counselor. He's going to be mighty God. He's going to have all the power of God to affect God's reign. He's going to be the eternal father, you know, father outside of the whole kind of world, as it were, and the Prince of Peace. Highfalutin, powerful imagery for Hezekiah. One can understand how later on, people who see Jesus as the Christ will find themselves readily able to use that language of him. And the third and final point that came in this very critical period of breakdown but development of ideas concerning the king was the idea of the universal kingdom. The Assyrian kingdom, up till then, I suppose we can only think within our time, Judah was thought of as a very powerful kingdom, in its own little way. And they remembered David's kingdom as taking in the whole area, and they thought that was amazing. But look at Assyria, Tigris, Euphrates, up the north, right down into Egypt. Ideas, they started to think of the possibility of God's kingdom being a world kingdom, you know, like their vision was expanded by seeing an example of it. And you'll find some texts at this time capturing that image of the universal kingdom of God. Isaiah 2:2-3. In the days to come, the mountain of the temple of Yahweh shall tower above the mountains. All the nations will stream to it. Come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the temple of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways. All the nations will come to Jerusalem. Temple, throne, priest, king, holy place. And this universal kingdom was seen as a reversal of sin, which is what you'd expect, and a going back to the Garden of Eden, which is their blueprint of what the world should be like coming from God, the beautiful garden of peace and so on. And you find in Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 9, he captures that imagery and promises a time when the universal kingdom of God will be like the Garden of Eden. A shoot springs from the stock of Jesse. Jesse is the father of David. So someone from the dynasty of David. On him the Spirit of Yahweh rests. With equity he gives a verdict for the poor of the land. Note how that comes back again and again and again. It's a key element in the whole of their understanding of God the Redeemer. Equity, justice for the poor. And here's the imagery. The wolf lives with the lamb. The panther lies down with the kid. Calf and lion cub feed together with a little boy to lead them. I presume little Hezekiah, seen there as the one in whom they're putting their hope. They do no hurt, no harm on all my holy mountain, for the country is filled with the knowledge of Yahweh as the waters swell the sea. The next historical event that develops the idea of the Christ, and we're concentrating on King at the moment, was the extraordinary, fatal, tragic, totally unexpected and completely kind of mind-blowing thing of the destruction of Jerusalem. I can't get a whole feel of it, I can get a little bit of it. But it's just that nobody thought it was possible. I mean, to me, it would be far more than this. But in a way, I think, if I think as a Catholic, it's hard for me to imagine, say Rome were just obliterated, bombed out, absolutely. And, you know, and for 2,000 years we've been thinking of Rome and the See of Rome and the Pope in Rome. You know all that? Like, it's a long tradition. You kind of just take it for granted. God's city destroyed by a pagan king or pagan god. How could that happen when God's the Almighty One? God's temple desecrated by pagan religion. It's almost like, how could it happen? Because it's God's temple. You get the feel of it, right? But it happened. And through it all, I suppose most people despaired or just lost faith, perhaps, I don't know. Just dropped everything because it was just futile. I wouldn't know. But we have a record of some faithful ones who knew, they came to see that there, as we looked at when we did the Servant of Yahweh, that new spirituality that developed during the time of the exile, placed not on institutions but on God, and a new humility, a new awareness of what we put our trust in. Well, the great Ezekiel, a priest, and Jeremiah, a priest, both priests of the exile period, still clung and tried by their words, oracles from their prayer, to get the people to continue trusting that God's promise to the king would be fulfilled. And Ezekiel 37:24 says, "My servant David will reign over them, one shepherd for all." And when you think of shepherd in Jewish literature, please don't think of a bleating sheep in a country paddock or nice little lambkins in a little meadow. The shepherd, I mean, they were nomad people. And the patriarch with his great crook, the great leader, what we'd call the king, I don't know, the leader was the main shepherd. And so it's a powerful position for nomad people who live, that's their economy, that's their whole life. So the shepherd is the shepherd king, the leader shepherd. "My servant David will reign over them, one shepherd for all. They will live in the land in which your ancestors lived." And he's saying this from the waters of Babylon. He's writing over in Babylon, in exile, confident that it'll come. "Forever they will live there. I, Yahweh, shall make a covenant of peace with them, an eternal covenant. I shall resettle them, settle my sanctuary among them forever, and all the nations will learn that I'm Yahweh, the sanctifier of Israel." And likewise, at much the same time, Jeremiah 23:5 writes about a virtuous branch for David, a branch of the family, just branch, who will reign as true king and be wise, practicing honesty and integrity in the land. But it didn't happen. And now I take you to the last little step before the break. I mean, there wasn't the king, the last king of Judah reigned in the year 487. And he was the uncle of the king who'd been taken away into Babylon. And an old fuddy-duddy who tried to get a revolution was finally brought about the destruction of the city by his stupidity, really. And so that was Zedekiah. So that's 487. That's 500 years from King David to Zedekiah. 400, isn't it? Yes, 587, isn't it? Sorry. The destruction of Jerusalem. So 400 years of king, and then it finished. No more. They go into exile. When they come back from exile, the extraordinary coming back, they're led by a relation, a cousin, a kind of a lateral line person called Zerubbabel, or Shealtiel, it's all a little bit confused, who comes back with them as, not the king, but as the vicegerent of the king of Persia, who let them back, and he fades out of the picture within about 20 years, and then the person in charge is the high priest, who's a Levite, nothing to do with Judah. The king's just finished. And so develops some of their hopes. Zechariah and Haggai had hopes that Zerubbabel would become king somehow, and it would all happen through. But when he faded out of the picture, well, something was born called messianism. And I think the idea is simple enough. While there's a king on the throne, people's hopes are in the king. You see that, obviously. But when there's no king, and there won't be a king for 600 years. By the time Jesus comes, there's been no king for 600 years. How people kept their hope, I don't know. And they can hardly trace back who was who by then, I imagine, though they had little anthologies trying to do so, but they differ. So you've got born in that time because now of the promises of God to Nathan, by Nathan to David, because of God's fidelity, because God had said the king is the one to build his house, because God had said your dynasty will be secure forever. The people, many of them, had hopes that one day a charismatically endowed son of David would come and restore God's kingdom and achieve God's effective reign. Instead of looking at the present to the king, hoping for him, their vision went into the future, and that's messianism. A future look, a promised one who will come. We haven't got one, so he has to be someone that will come. And they're looking forward to the coming of the Messiah, or the Christos in Greek, the Christ, the Anointed One. Jumping now, because I have to the time of Jesus, it seems from all the evidence available, and there's plenty, so I think this can be made confidently, that there was a heightened expectation at that time that a Messiah was imminent. Basically because things were coming to a head. I suppose they'd come to a head before. They'd come to a head under the Maccabees in the 3rd century or the early 2nd century BC. But here it was again, and at times of great revolution and breakdown and conflict, I suppose one's hopes get lifted. And with the Roman occupation, the birth of the Zealot movement, and the conflict that was emerging in that torn country at the time that Jesus was born and bred and grew up, there was a great expectation that a son of David, a spirit-filled, anointed Christ would emerge out of who knew where, who would be the son of David and fulfill all those hopes and would bring about the great kingdom of God, peace, justice on earth. Other people when they thought of the Messiah, didn't think king at all. For example, the Samaritans. Just to remind you of that, to help, it makes it a bit complex, but the Samaritans are the people from the kind of northern kingdom who'd been intermarried with the Babylonians and so on, and the Assyrians and whatever. And they had nothing to do with Judah, nothing to do with Jerusalem, nothing to do with the king. They didn't want a king. They saw a king as a totally irreverent thing, because only God was their king. They put all their faith in the Moses and the... They were looking forward to the Christos, as I've explained, who's the prophet, eh? So when you get to John's Gospel, for example, and that woman of Samaria says, the Christ will come, she's not thinking of a charismatically endowed son of David. She wouldn't want that. God, that could only be the worst thing that could happen. She meant by Christos, Christ, Messiah, she meant the prophet whom Moses had promised would come, the anointed prophet. There were other groups you can find, for example, in the scrolls of Qumran, the Essene people, when they thought of the Christ, they were thinking of a priest figure, huh? A sanctuary person. So at the time of Jesus, obviously when you're thinking of a future hope and dreams brought out of promises, you're going to be totally vague. But there was a heightened hope that an anointed one, whether priest, prophet, and for most of them thought king, that such a person would emerge. It seems that a number of Jesus' contemporaries thought of him as that one, and therefore thought of him as the Christ.